Since 1775, generations of Americans have fought for our ideals and our principles. American warriors secured the freedoms to create the United States of America. They fought to end slavery. They joined with allies to win two world wars. They have responded with valor and honor whenever called. And they have liberated more people around the globe than any military in the history of the world. Our all-volunteer forces of guardsmen, soldiers, sailors, marines, airmen, and reservists continue the mission begun at Lexington and Concord. Less than 1% of Americans serve in our armed forces. The least the rest of us can do is to pay attention and get engaged. This program is produced and broadcast for that purpose. It is presented live and worldwide at 1041kqth.com. To engage, call 520-751-1041. The American Warrior is on the air.
Good afternoon, folks. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Christmas is a time for family and friends, food, warmth, and comfort. So you'll forgive me if I take you out of your comfort zone here for just an hour. The mission of American Warrior Radio is to educate those who never serve by communicating the stories of those who do. There seems to be a broadening gap between those who serve and those of us who, simply put, get to enjoy the benefits of their service, whether we think about it or not. And thinking about how to wrap up our 2017 broadcast year, it struck me that one of the best times to drive this point home is a time when most of us are surrounded by that which we hold dear, family, friends, peace, and hope. The promise of Christmas is one of hope. The men and women who serve in our military and those who serve in our communities are often away from family during the holidays, standing the watch so that we can enjoy our time in safety and comfort. A gift we can give them is recognition and appreciation for that sacrifice. I can't think of a better way to make you appreciate the magnitude of that sacrifice than to provide a very stark contrast, a contrast between what I hope you and your family are experiencing this holiday season and what some of our military experience. I mentioned the gifts of Christmas, family, friends, food, peace, and hope. For several Christmas holidays, today's guest only had one of those elements, hope, and its promise. Welcome to American Warrior Radio, Colonel Lee Ellis, United States Air Force, retired.
Thank you, Ben. Good morning. Good to be with you.
Lee, it is truly an honor to have you on. You know, what you survived as a POW in Vietnam is an amazing story, and I want you to tell that story a little bit later on the show. But I guess more importantly for me, Lee, what you did with those experiences after coming home is an even more amazing story. I was kind of giving you a hard time about being on that CNN and those other guys here, but boy, talk about making lemonade out of lemons.
Yeah, well, I've been very blessed. I came home and was in good enough physical condition and mental condition that I was able to return to flying as an active duty flyer in the Air Force, which had always been my dream to be a pilot in the Air Force. And that went well. I had a very good flying career. I requalified down in San Antonio at Randolph Air Force Base and was an instructor pilot. Worked my way up at flight commander, section commander, operations officer, chief pilot, and then check pilot, and then squadron commander. So that was all so good. And I've been very fortunate in my leadership roles because I've had really good people that made me look good. Everywhere I've been, I've just always had really good people. And I guess when I didn't have good people, I had enough forethought and experience to figure out what to do in that case. But they made me successful, and so I've enjoyed that. I enjoyed my time in the military. My last two assignments, I moved into leadership development as a full colonel at two schools, the Squadron Officer School for Captains in the Air Force. We had over 4,000 go through a year. It was about a six-week course, and then I ran the ROTC at the University of Georgia for my last assignment, which was also great. I love working with young people. I like seeing them develop. I like being a part of their life and helping them kind of along the way, mentoring them. It's just always brought me great rewards to mentor others and see them go do well.
Now, Lee, I tell you, I first came to be acquainted with you when at that time, three-star general, someone we both know, Robin Rand, he's not wearing four stars on his shoulder, introduced me to you. I was his honorary commander, and he said, literally, if you want to know about leadership, you need to read this book. And it gave me a copy of your book, Leading with Honor. You, a tremendous read, Lee. You have now got a second book out as well, if I'm not mistaken. It's been out about a year.
That's right. Engage with Honor, Building a Culture of Courageous Accountability. We need accountability. it really starts with you, the individual. You have to be accountable to yourself before you can hold others accountable. But I really believe that leader's responsibility is to help people be successful. And if the leader's doing his or her job well, then 95% or more of their people are going to be successful, which makes the organization successful. So I think so much of accountability is really dependent upon the leader. But back to that transition, you know, out of the Air Force, I got involved in developing assessments for career assessment program, and that we stood that up, and that worked well. And then somehow some people asked me about consulting with them on their hiring and the managing of the people they had in their businesses. And as I fell into that, it just seemed like I found my next home. It was as exciting as flying airplanes, very rewarding, and I just saw all of my experience as a leader, all my learnings that I'd had along the way and those leadership schools coming to play, and then I had these assessments. So for the last 20 years, I've been a leadership consultant, coach, and then became an author and a speaker and trainer along the way throughout that. So it's just really been a delight to be able to do that.
Now, Lee, let me ask you, because I guess what I was hoping to go with, or frankly, the reason I thought of you, well, two reasons. One is I actually saw one of your blog posts that you posted up on leadingwithhonor.com. But so it really struck me about when you think about holidays and away from family serving our nation, the most extreme case is what you went through for 5.5 years there in Vietnam. But also the idea of hope and renewal. And at least what I get from your messages, you're out there talking to leaders and you talk about honor and you talk about integrity and you talk about the courage to do the right thing. That's sort of a message of renewal for organizations as well, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But of course, renewal for organizations has to have buy-in and preferably leadership, but certainly buy-in from the top. And so in order to make that move along, the leader has to embrace that and engage in some renewal themselves. You know, I'm a lifelong learner. Some people I know are amazed that I'm still working to, you know, become a better person first and a better leader, a better friend, a better husband. It enriches my life to continue to grow. Now, is it hard? Absolutely. Does it take courage? Oh, definitely. It takes a lot of courage because the biggest battle that I have to fight is my own ego and my pride and my fears. And that's true, I think, for anybody. We have to be willing to go to battle against our pride, our fears, our feelings of insecurity, and to accept the fact that we don't have to be perfect. In fact, we aren't perfect. And when we live in that vulnerability, that makes us authentic. And people who are authentic are very attractive to others at home, at work, or wherever. So, you know, having people willing to take on, I try to convince people to be willing to take on this renewal process or growth process, however you want to call it, because it is so rewarding. Not easy, but very rewarding.
Okay, well, we're going to talk more about that later on in the show, but like I mentioned Christmas, before we share that Christmas story that you posted on your blog, Lee, real quick, we've got about 3 minutes before the first break. Tell us how on earth a young boy from Commerce, Georgia, ended up being a guest at probably the most infamous Hilton in the world, the Hanoi Hilton.
Yeah. Well, I didn't sign up for being a POW. I signed up to be an Air Force pilot and then a fighter pilot. I went through my flight training in Moody Air Force, Valdosta, Georgia, and then out to George Air Force Base in the high desert of California, similar to what Tucson's like there, where you are. Great flying, but it was all combat-oriented, very much like Top Gun, except we also did the air-to-ground stuff. So quick as we were, about 6 months' worth of qualifying, getting combat ready in the Air Force Phantom, which was the hot rod of the day, I went to Vietnam. I was flying out of Da Nang in South Vietnam, the very northern part of South Vietnam, up near the DMZ where North Vietnam is. I had flown a number of missions over Laos and a number of mission close air support for the Army and Marine Corps in South Vietnam. But my primary missions were flying armed reconnaissance up and down the Ho Chi Minh trails in North Vietnam. And I had 53 of those. I was on my 53rd, actually, when I was shot down. You had to get 100 or be there a year before you could go home. And I was planning on finishing my 100 in about 9 months and headed back home. But on the 53rd, when my airplane was hit and blew up over enemy territory, actually blew into several pieces. Unfortunately, my partner and I were able to eject, but we were surrounded and captured immediately after hitting the ground. And from there, we took us about a couple of weeks to get to the Hanoi Hilton, arrived there on November the 21st, 1967, just, you know, about a month before Christmas, which was good and bad.
And why do you say that? I can see why it was bad, but what's the good in that, Lee?
Well, it was good in that they actually were putting on a little show of kind of for propaganda purposes about how well they were going to be treating, they were treating POWs. Of course, they were torturing people, but they also were planning for a Christmas thing to happen. And, of course, the first time, right after I got there, I've been there about 2 or 3 days, and one day this interrogator, who used a lot of English idioms, first night we were there, he looked at, put his arms, crossed his arms and leaned across the table and looked over at me and a couple other guys that were going to be my cellmates and said, "And now the fat is in the fire, huh?" And so that was so bizarre. I'll tell you, I almost laughed in his face, but I was too scared. But he opened a porthole one day and he said, "Are you preparing for Christmas? Are you preparing for Christmas?" And I had no idea. All I could picture was communists hate Christians and Christmas. They're probably going to torture a few people for Christmas. And this is his sad joke. That's what I was thinking. But I'll tell you the rest of the story a little later if you want.
Okay, well, let's do that. Let's take a break here, and then we come back. I want you to share the story that you post on your blog, because there's so many messages there in what you did. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined live by Colonel Lee Ellis. Colonel Ellis was a Vietnam POW 5.5 years during the war in Vietnam, and he shares some very special thoughts with us this holiday on what our military are going through. Stick around, folks. We'll be right back.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American warrior.
So to honor him, pa-ra-pa-pum-pum, when we came.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. A very special guest joining us here in this holiday time. I talked about how important it is for those of us who get to spend time with our families during the holidays to remember those who are separated from their families very, very often in the line of fire and harm's way. Our guest today, Colonel Lee Ellis, spent 5.5 years as a POW in Vietnam, some of it at the Hanoi Hilton. I think, is that Lee? Were you there the whole, all 5.5 years, or did you get moved around?
No, I was there 9 months and then out to Son Tay for 2 years and then to another camp for about 3 months, and then back to the Hilton for 19 months, and the Chinese border hidden away in the mountains for 9 or 10 months, and then back to Hanoi to the plantation for release.
Now, well, let's talk about that. I was referencing, I read a situation you had. I mean, Christmas, I just can't imagine the conditions. Maybe that's the place to start. I checked the weather report for Hanoi today. I think it's supposed to be 77 degrees, 55 degrees at night, which sounds nice and balmy, but I'm guessing in your situation, maybe just let's start off by giving our listeners sort of a feel of what you and your fellow patriots there were experiencing in these horrible, horrible mm-hmm. conditions in these mm-hmm. prisoner war camps, Lee.
Well, when I got to Hanoi, went into a cell that was kind of maximum security in that it had no walls touching other walls. So communication was very, very limited, almost non-existent. They had guards in the hallways, and we had rules on the back of our door, and one of the very first ones was we could not talk loudly. We had to whisper. If they heard us in the hallways, we would be punished. And so very difficult to communicate, guards out there patrolling the hall, that sort of thing. And they just had a comm purge just before we got there, and nobody wanted to communicate because the torture and the punishment had been terrible. So It was kind of a shut down, no communication environment for a while. But this cell was 6.5 feet by 7 feet, 6.5 feet wide, 7 feet long. And there were stocks on the two bottom beds. Now, these beds were kind of like bunk beds in that they were about 28 to 30 inches wide, wooden boards fastened to one side, one wall. There was a low one and a high one, and then a space in the middle about 16 inches wide where we could walk between the two bunk beds, I'm calling them. And on the right side, there was 28 to 30 inch wide boards, low and high. And the two on the bottom had stocks in them, so they could actually lock you down in with your ankles in the stocks. I slept on the high one on the inside wall, inside being inside to the prison compound, the prison yard, and it had one window way up high, actually a little bit higher than where the bed was, the sleeping boards, and it was about 10 inches high and about 25 or 30 inches wide, had bars in it. It was covered with a rattan mat. The cell had one little low watt bulb hanging down, and it burned all night long and was turned off in the daytime. So it was quite an existence, 6.5 by 7 feet with a 16 inch wide walking space. We didn't have a bathroom, of course, but we did have a 3 gallon bucket, and thank goodness it had a lid. We were fed twice a day, boiled soup, which was really good, that was boiled. What wasn't so good is there wasn't much in it except a few greens or a few chunks of pumpkin. So it was a thin, watery soup with a cup of rice on the side or a small baguette of bread. So we were hungry a lot. We got there the 21st of November, as I said, and it was a cold winter that first winter. Cold meaning, probably a lot of days in the 60s, a few times in the 70s, but a lot of days in the 50s, and at night it would dip down, closer to 50, maybe even below, but let's say 50 to 52 degrees.
And you're sleeping on concrete pretty much.
On a wooden bed with the one blanket and a pair of pajamas to wear. And, 52 degrees is not cold, unless when you have heat, you can go back inside. But if you have no heat, and that cold concrete, it just gets really cold soaked. And so we were cold. And that, of course, it took a lot more calories to stay warm. So we're burning up what few calories we're getting out of the bread. We're burning up every day before the next meal came. The first meal is about 9:30. The second meal about 4:30. So they came close together. But from 4:30 in the afternoon till 9:30 the next morning is a long haul. And I'd wake up about 5 every morning, and I would be dreaming that I was in a cafeteria with a tray, and I'm getting eggs and sausage and bacon and toast and grits and hash browns and orange juice and coffee. And about that time, I'd wake up. So for years, we dreamed about food.
Now, Lee, as I recall from our previous conversations, it seems like that was the first place you hit when you got back stateside.
Yeah, we landed at Clark Air Base the day we were released. We got in there about 4 o'clock, and we had a briefing. And we went upstairs and took off those clothes, coming home clothes, and put on our pajamas and robe for the hospital, pajama clothes, hospital clothes. And then we marched down to the chow hall and the cafeteria at Clark Air Base Hospital. And it was a big hospital, so it had plenty of room for us. And we went through that line, and I did it exactly like I dreamed. And I ate all that, except I had 3 or 4 eggs. And then I went back and got a couple more eggs and a steak. And after eating that, I went back and got apple pie and ice cream. So we didn't have any problem eating.
Well, and I think I bring that up because I want a contrast. We've got about 3 minutes before the next break, but let's talk about 5.5 years as a POW, Lee. Given when you were captured, I'm guessing that meant at least 5 Christmas holidays for you, separated from your family or pretty much any sort of human comfort. Were there any, you never had a normal Christmas, Lee, but in those 5 years, were there any that even came close to approximating? I mean, I've heard stories of them setting up a Christmas tree, or even one case, I guess it was the nativity scene, and the prisoner of war was ordered to kneel there for the appropriate amount of time. I think maybe the prison guards thought it was a different kind of religion where you had to bow and pray, or what?
Yeah. Well, they were always trying to capture photo ops, okay? So every Christmas, every holiday, Ho Chi Minh's birthday, 4th of July, they're always looking for those photo ops. And they're all right now in the Hanoi Hilton is a museum. And you go there and they can show you how well the POWs are treated. But those were kind of one of a kind. I never went to church. And there were a few, the Catholics got to go to Mass, in which time they were basically, they went because they got to see other POWs, which was kind of rare, but they got a sermon from the priest about, you know, they needed to repent, of course. It was a special sermon for them. But, there really wasn't much celebration at Christmas from the enemy's part other than to give us what was called a special meal, and it was kind of a special meal. So that was good. We look forward to that. I don't recall having any other great events there. But
welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Hey, listen, that song you heard coming back from the break, that was given to us by Glenn Boudreau. Glenn's a great patriot down there in Texas, also writes and sings his song. Glenn, thank you so much for sharing that special holiday wish out there for our men and women in the military. We're back with Lee Ellis. Lee was a POW in Vietnam for 5.5 years. He's now a consultant, author, and speaker. You can learn more at leadingwithhonor.com. I read his book, his original book, Leading with Honor. Lee, I need to get your second one and read that too, but just an amazing case of lessons learned. I kind of lightheartedly talked at the top of the show about making lemonade out of lemons. You made gallons of lemonade out of your bad situation there, Lee, but just some wonderful, wonderful things. We're talking specifically about what our men and women of the military go through when they're separated from their families. In your case, probably the most extreme separation is a POW. But you make a good point. I don't want to focus just on your side because there's families at home that are suffering as well. I mean, Christmas holidays are a family time. You're in a cell in Vietnam. Lee, do you know how soon did these families know that somebody was a POW and not missing in action? Do you have a sense of that?
It varied quite a bit. I can tell you that I have friends who, one friend, I was in his wedding. He was shot down in August 1967, a couple months before me, and his wife never heard. He was MIA for almost 6 years. When I came home, she called me and said, "Was Tom there?" And I said, "No, he was never amongst our group." She said, "Well, I'm going to have his status change from MIA to KIA. Mm. And then I'm going to move on with my life." She had waited faithfully for almost 6 years. So in some cases, people did know right away. In some cases, it was 2 or 3 years. My family knew that I was alive on the ground because they saw me parachute. The wingman saw me parachute out. And then I actually was able to pull out my radio and make one quick radio call before I was captured. And then captured, and then they didn't hear from me for a couple of years. It was 2.5. I wrote my first letter at about the 2-year point, but they held it back for 6 months. So my family got it at 2.5 years. But there was a person who was released early after I'd been there about 1.5 years, and I had actually seen this person eyeball to eyeball across the campground and was able to spell out my name, writing it out by taking my index finger on my right hand and writing on my left palm, spelling out words, spell out my name, and he saw my face. So he was able to come back and tell, you know, DOD and my family that I was there and alive. And this was, I'd been there, you know, close to 2 years then. So it was a long time for many people. Some people were declared dead while they were, and they was actually alive as POWs. And in fact, one of my Navy friends, that his wife was in Atlanta, and they gave her a little tombstone. Mm. Said he was dead, and she put it in her backyard and said, "I don't think so." And sure enough, her husband came home 7.5 years after he went missing.
Well, you talk about one of the greatest gifts of all, huh?
Yeah, yeah. But the families, they just had the real battle, and I think they always do with the warriors in the military, because we knew what was happening to us. We knew we were alive. We knew we were fighting a battle, but we were winning that battle every day by getting through the day and not collaborating with the enemy. That was our battle, not to give them any propaganda or give them anything without making them earn it and then messing it up so it came out obviously tortured if they did get to that point. So we knew about us, but the families, you can just imagine, you know, if you know your son or daughter is missing and maybe dead, maybe alive, maybe in a POW camp, you don't know what's happening to them. So that's one thing. Another, you know, I just finished reading a great book by Evelyn Guarino. Her husband, Larry Guarino, was a POW for almost 8 years, and she raised four boys. It's a wonderful book, and it goes into what she had to go through dealing with the government, about her husband, dealing with neighbors and friends who didn't understand her position, raising four boys. It was just and the stress of trying to get letters in and out to her husband. It was just her resilience. She should have been given the Medal of Honor for resilience, and so many of the wives and families. My mom and dad were that way. They did such a great job. They didn't get the rewards. And when we came home, the POWs came home, we just wanted to go back to work and have our own normal life. And in retrospect, I did not celebrate and fully honor, I think, the suffering that my family had done during that time.
So I'm guessing, Lee, if one could, and you know, keep in mind, I think so often people hear POW and, you know, if they're my generation, they think of Hogan's Heroes and, you know, not that was a comfy existence for the real World War II POWs, but what you and your comrades were experiencing was something very, very different. The North Vietnamese had never probably even heard of the Geneva Accords, much less applied them. So you guys were in a real rough spot. I'm assuming, Lee, it was pretty much an unwritten code that for anyone who did get out, one of the things you tried to do is communicate back once you got stateside or back to the military about who you did see and who was still alive then?
Yeah, that was, you know, they went through an extensive debrief. There were three in 1968, I'm sorry, about six, three in 68, there'll be six. And then there were a total of about 12, all in groups of threes that were released over a period of 3 or 4 years. And they were always always propaganda releases, usually to some peace group that came over to Vietnam. And, you know, it was just a way for them to, the communists, to get some good PR. Of course, eventually the tables turned because the National League of POW/MIA families got organized. And so all these wives and moms and dads got organized, and they got millions of letters written. They went to Paris and confronted the communist diplomats there at the Paris peace talks. And they really started to get some good, and they got the government, our government, to change its policy and start putting pressure on the communists about our treatment and about accountability and who is a POW, who's not, and all that sort of stuff. And then when Ho Chi Minh died in late 1969, and a few months later, they decided to completely change our treatment. They stopped calling us criminals. They stopped the torture for the most part. And we kind of went to a live and let live situation. So it was actually the families who didn't know what the outcome was going to be, kind of their hope for probably, but unknown consequences of their action. They changed the government of the U.S. and they changed the policy of the U.S. government, and they changed the policy of the communist government in Hanoi. And our treatment got better, and it changed our lives like you can't imagine. That was the best Christmas gift we ever got, was what the families did to make a lot of PR work, bring it to the not only the attention of the American people, but the international community about the plight of the POWs, and that pressure caused the communists to change our treatment.
Lee, we've got about 2 minutes before we need to pay for the show again, but real quick, it strikes me as amazing. You mentioned that, you know, we had a little fun with it. You're in a prisoner of war camp being mistreated, but I've read that you once said even the smallest victories were important in this war of wills. Maybe in just a couple of minutes, Lee, can you share with us some of the things? I think you guys, you know, when they're pressing you for information, you said the commander on that mission was Clark Kent or Bruce Wayne, or what was some of the stuff that you guys did?
Yeah, they said, who were some of the guys who they were two Navy POWs were being tortured for information and for propaganda. And they wanted them to write a little article on who are the Navy POWs who were air aviators who refused to fly combat missions saying the war was wrong. And so it was Clark Kent and Ben Casey, Dr. Ben Casey. Of course, everybody knew those were made up names, and no American would do that of his own free will. other than to pull the wool over their eyes. And so we all had a good laugh, but those guys, they got beat up. And once, and actually one of the peace warriors that came over, the peace committee came over and told the communists, well, those guys pulled the wool over your eyes. Everybody in America is laughing at you because those are not military people. Those are TV people. And so those guys got punished pretty bad. But we would do things like that all the time, wherever we could, to kind of put the stick in their eye to mess up any propaganda. But little things every day, you know, they wanted us to bow, and that was a big deal. That was one of the rules in the camp. You had to bow when we saw them, you know, like salute, but we had to bow and show humility to them. Of course, we fought that day in, day out, and sometimes we, you know, we'd give in because the pain was too much, because they would beat you over the head, grab your head and push it down, and put you in handcuffs and leg irons and so on. So, but it was like guerrilla warfare. We would do it when we could get away with it, as long as we could get away with it. And then when the pain got too bad, we'd comply, but we'd start over again the next day.
Okay.
And of course, the communication was the same thing. We were forbidden to communicate, but very quickly we had methods of communicating, tapping on the walls, Morse code, and different types of codes. And we would just take, we were pretty clever about figuring out ways to beat them.
Okay. Well, I tell you, folks, your host, I want to keep going, Lee, but we have to take a break. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Colonel Lee Ellis, United States Air Force retired, an amazing author, an amazing speaker. You can find out more at leadingwithhonor.com. Lee, when we come back, we'll have about 9 minutes. We'd love to have you just share your thoughts on the holidays as a POW, and maybe your thoughts going out to some of our men and women in the military today and what they're going through. Stick around, folks. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by author and speaker and consultant, and just overall, I tell you what, folks, a guy that's inspired me ever since I first came to know him, Colonel Lee Ellis, United States Air Force retired. Lee, we're talking about your time in the POW camps, 5.5 years in Vietnam. You obviously missed a lot of holidays there. I'd like to sort of transition now into translating that to what's happening now and sort of your perspective on, well, let me back up a little bit. So one of the things that really struck me, Lee, and it wasn't at Christmas, but you tell a story about how you'd been a prisoner of war for about 2 years, 2.5 years. A package comes from your family. They open it up. They put it before you, and there's warm socks, and there's family photos, and there's food and vitamins and just all the stuff that you want. But they insisted you sign a receipt for it. And mm-hmm. You knew that these things were being used for propaganda, so you went with your conscience and without the package, which was a tremendously courageous thing to do. But I know there was a code of honor for POWs. We all have our limits. And I'm guessing not everybody... Well, I mean, just before we get into what's happening at Christmas now, could you just maybe share what you learned and how to... I'm trying to find what you said. Basically, you turned that fear and that pain into, you learned to lean into the pain of your fears and doubts, I think is your quote, Lee.
Yeah. You know, one of the things, we're working on a movie right now, believe it or not. That's what I've been doing this morning, reviewing the treatment for this movie. But the idea that we have doubts and fears, and they take us out of being the people that we're really committed to be. They take us away from our integrity. They take us away from our mission and our calling. And so we learned in that situation, because of our commitment to honorable, to the code of conduct, to our fellow POWs, to our country, we learned that we had to lean into the pain of our doubts and fears and figure out what the right thing to do was, and then do it and be willing to suffer to do the right thing. And that has such great rewards. Suffering, we learned, won't kill you. Most of the time, suffering doesn't kill you, and you come out better the other side. And so as we face each day, learning to just say, what is the right thing to do here? We generally know, and lean into the pain of our doubts and fears and come up with a plan and go do it. It's such a rewarding thing. And I spend a good bit of my time in speaking and coaching and consulting, just doing that, because that will take care of a lot of things. Now, the story of the package I received, that first package, I was so wanting to have that package, but they wanted me to find this receipt, and in the receipt it said, because of the lenient, humane policy of the Democratic Republic of North Vietnam. Well, there was no way that I was going to sign that, because they'd been torturing, I'd been tortured the year before, but they had been recently torturing some of my cellmates. So there's no way I could, get in good conscience, sign that. Now, a lot of guys did, and it was okay. It was approved to be okay. But I said, I'm not going to do it. And enough guys were like me that the next time the packages came, that statement had been taken out. I signed the receipt, and I got my package. So I felt like that was a true victory. And I did miss a package, but, you know, in the long run, it was worth it. And that sacrifice was worth it, and I was glad I did it.
Absolutely. Now, another small victory.
Yes, it was. It was a big victory, I thought.
Yeah. Now, Lee, I tell you, I want to, real quick, we've got about 5 minutes, but there's something based on your perspective and your wisdom over the years. You know, I talk a lot about family and the joys of mm-hmm. Christmas, but I'm guessing for a lot of our military folks out there, Christmas can be a wonderful time if you've got someone, if you're surrounded by that love and comfort. But what about those folks who don't have that? What about the folks who are out there alone?
Yeah. You know, as a POW, that's the worst place you can be, is alone. And we all realize that, because they would actually put people in isolation every place they could. If they had enough spaces, we'd all been in solitary. So we know the danger of being alone and being in a oppressive environment, or being under stress and being alone. That's not good. It's never good to be alone anyway. So what we would do is we would risk our lives to get to someone who's alone and say, hey, we're with you, man. We're proud of you. We appreciate you. You're fighting a good battle. We wish we could be with you today, but just know that we're with you in spirit, and we're just proud of you. Those kind of things, to build people up who were fighting a battle, because even though it was inevitable that they could defeat you in the moment and make you submit and do something through torture, even though we knew that, it's still at the same time, it was very depressing. And, you know, I remember being tortured and feeling like I was the lowest form of life that ever lived on earth, because I wasn't tough enough to beat them. So we have to reach out to people around us. Now, where we can be together, that's powerful. Now, obviously, when you get people together, families together, there's always baggage around. We got to avoid the baggage during the holidays and be together and focus just on the positive things and be a giver, not a taker. Don't expect everybody to live up to where you think they ought to be. Just accept them where they are. As POWs, we learn to do this. I live with guys in the same cell for as many as 3 years and never more than 30 feet from them. Can you imagine that? 24 hours a day, except when we're being tortured. So being able to accept people where they are, to care about them, and to show them how important and valuable they are to you. When you do that, it inspires them. It gives them positive energy. It gives them the courage to fight the battles that they have in life. And so that's, I think, the best gift we can give at Christmas, is to give the gift of encouragement and affirmation, acceptance to others. We needed that desperately in POW camps, and we gave it freely. I'm trying to keep that habit. It's a struggle sometimes, but I'm trying to keep that habit, and I would encourage others to do that too.
Wow. Strong, strong finish, Lee. One more minute. Any other messages you want to send out to our listeners or their families?
Be mindful of the families in your community who have people deployed off in foreign lands, and reach out to them. Just let them know you care and you appreciate what they're doing. That's very important.
There you go. Thank you so much, Lee. Honestly, sir, it's been a pleasure knowing you. I count you as a resource, and I'm so glad you took some time out on your holiday to spend with our listeners and share these thoughts. God bless you, sir, and your family and what you do continue to do out there. Folks, you can find out more if you'd like to. He is for hire. I can't afford him, but he can come in and speak to you. Check out his books. You can learn more, leadingwithhonor.com. Share this message. It's so important, folks. Visit us at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. The podcast of this interview and over 150 others are available out there. We need more and more pairs of ears to hear these messages so the civilian world understands why it's important to support those men and women of our military and the first responders protecting us here on the front home front. Check out American Warrior Radio on Facebook and also on Twitter at Warrior Radio TUC. Lee, thank you so much, and we hope to catch up with you again soon.
Ben, always good to be with you. God bless.
All right, you too, sir. That's it, ladies and gentlemen. Great show coming up to the end of the year. Next week here on American Warrior Radio, we look forward to talking to you more in 2018. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, all policies and procedures are to remain in place.